Some weeks ago, I read an article by Andrew Root, who teaches at Luther Seminary. The article was titled, Forming a People to Pray. Knowing that this sermon was coming up, I copied it and laid it on the corner of my desk. When I looked at it again this week, I found a few interesting things. One was a reference to an experiment in the area of visual cognition done by Daniel Simons some time back. In the study, the subjects were asked to watch a video of people in black shirts and white shirts passing a basketball back and forth, and to count how many times the people in the white shirts touched the basketball. Meanwhile, a person in a gorilla suit came walking through the frame. Afterwards, the people who watched the video, the subjects of the study, were asked if they saw the gorilla. Half of the people who participated had no idea there was a person in a gorilla suit who had walked through the frame of the video, many even insisting that it was not possible. How does something like that happen? How can a person in a gorilla suit walk through the frame unnoticed? Apparently, focusing on those in white shirts, because that was the assignment, to count the passes of the basketball by the people in the white shirts, causes about half of the people watching the video to block out those in black, including the gorilla-suited person. The author of the article I was reading noted that such observation blindness surprises us, but probably shouldn't. He says, perceptions of reality are contingent on our mode of attention. That is, we can and do miss hugely obvious realities when our attention is on something else. The gorilla suit experiment, as you might imagine, has been used to make all sorts of points, but this author wants to make this point. Part of what allows us or prevents us from seeing what is right in front of us is the frame through which we see the world. He says that our frame in Western culture is the immanent frame. So in other words, we count the physical material things that are right in front of us. It's what we do. It's what we see. He puts it this way, most people are unwilling to stop paying attention to what society deems important. They can't, as it were, stop counting the number of basketball passes or focusing on their bank accounts or Twitter followers, product promotions, or consumer purchases to attend to something different. Something perhaps that's not imminent, but transcendent. He goes on, pastors live in this imminent frame as well, drawn to paying attention to measurable things like church budgets, membership rolls, catalogs of programs, and data on denominational decline. Pastors have observational blindness, he says, though they may be too ashamed to admit it. In other words, it is possible that even people who have a calling to pay attention to God can stop seeing God, can stop seeing God's activity in the world. And yet, Root continues, real experiences of divine action occur. The problem is not that God is not visible, he writes, but that, to pursue the analogy, God is the gorilla to whose appearance we have been blinded. There is, however, a way to avoid this observational blindness, he continues, a way even to encounter the events of God. This is the way of prayer. Andrew Root sees the observational blindness that we have in relationship to God as a problem for all of us, but he writes and teaches pastors in particular, so he takes aim at people like me and my kind. And he says we should be doing less strategizing on how to get people interested in church and in God by bringing things that people are already interested in into the life of the church. And instead, we should be focusing on prayer. Because he says, focusing on prayer has the effect of broadening our attention on the world around us and training us to look for the arrival of God. So in praying, we seek God, and then perhaps we see God, and then hopefully we act on God's behalf. Last week, I talked in the context of the story of Mary and Martha about Jesus' invitation to be deeply present. I wonder whether this week's text flows from that, in the sense that along with Jesus' invitation to be deeply present is Jesus' invitation to be deeply aware and deeply engaged. So that when we receive the invitation to pray, what we hear is not an invitation to speak more words that address the divine, but what we hear is an invitation to see divine action around us, to see God at work, and to wonder about it, to yearn for it, to name what we see, to confess our difficulty in trusting it, to ask aloud how we can be involved, to express our questions about what might be best, and what would be in line with God's way and God's will. We often think of prayer as something that we do with our eyes closed. And we do that in part, I understand, to shut out the distractions of what might be going on around us. But what if prayer isn't so much what we do with our eyes closed as what we do with our eyes open? Because you have to have your eyes open to see God at work in the world, right? You have to have your eyes open to look into the eyes of the ones to whom your heart goes out. You have to have your eyes open to see the needs of the world. You have to have your eyes open to see the connections between what you are asking for and what you are willing to do about it. You have to have your eyes open to walk down the path of what you're praying for. When you pray, your eyes open. I came across a wonderful story this week in a podcast called Only a Game, hosted by Karen Given from NPR. It's a podcast about sports, but the story I listened to had two references to prayer, so it especially caught my attention this week. The basic story was this: two young men, both high school students, both African American, both with parents who were either dead or drug addicted, both with physical disabilities, both on the high school wrestling team in their Cleveland area high school, become best friends. The one boy is a double amputee. He lost both his legs when he was hit by a train at the age of 11. The other boy is legally blind. They become friends when the boy who is blind offers to carry the boy without legs, piggyback fashion, onto the team bus one day, a bus without any means of accessibility. The friendship grows from there. A picture of the two wrestlers, one carrying the other, is published in the city paper and comes to the attention of a woman who is a sports writer for ESPN. She asks her editor whether she can go to Cleveland to check out the story. The picture speaks to her. He agrees and she goes. Here's how that part of the story is told. She arrived during warm-ups for the wrestling match, but before she could introduce herself to Leroy and D'Artagnan, she was stopped by their coach. He said, "Hey, you the ESPN lady?" Lisa says, and I said, "Yes, I am." And I extended my hand to introduce myself, and he playfully slapped it away. And he leaned in and looked me in the eye and said, "You have been sent here by God. You know that?" He said, "Do you hear me? You've been sent here by God today." And he said this year he had been praying really hard for D'Artagnan and for Leroy because he felt once they graduate, the world has nothing for kids like them. That's the first reference to prayer. Sports reporter shows up for a story, nothing more, and the coach says, "You've been sent by God today because I've been praying for these boys and you showed up." The second reference to prayer in the story comes later, after Lisa has researched and written and edited and finally presented the story. By then, she is invested in not only the story, but in the lives of these two young men. She's crossed over from being reporter to being advocate. It's not what you're supposed to do according to journalistic ethics. But apparently, it is what you do when you are an answer to prayer. This is that part of the story. Lisa shot 120 hours of video, about 100 hours more than normal. She spent 2 months editing. That's a job that usually just takes 2 weeks. ESPN aired the story, and Leroy and D'Artagnan got on the phone as soon as it was over. The conversation was just, dude, I know, right, yeah, D'Artagnan says. It was just grunts and dudes, Leroy says, laughing. It was a very short conversation, and then we hung up. I mean, there was nothing else we needed to say, because everything was said in the story. We both just understood that it was powerful. D'Artagnan and Leroy didn't know how much power was in their story, but Lisa was starting to find out. I had spent that whole edit period sort of praying, she said, that just one person would see it and want to help. And that was a very small prayer, she says, because within minutes of the story airing, I started getting 2-3 emails a minute from people who saw it and wanted to help. Soon there was money for college, so Lisa helped Leroy and D'Artagnan make it through their entrance exams and college applications. She took them shopping for school supplies. Leroy moved to Phoenix to study video game development at Collins College of Design, and D'Artagnan attended school in Colorado while training for the Paralympic judo team in Colorado Springs. Lisa thought her job was done, but it was just beginning, end quote. There are ups and downs in the years that follow, but ultimately Lisa becomes an adopted mother of sorts to both of these young men. After all, who else do they have? They can't go back. There's nothing to go back to. They have to go forward, and how will they do it? Someone has to help them. Someone has to care about them, care for them. Someone has to pray for them and be an answer to prayer for them. And it turns out maybe they are an answer to Lisa's prayers as well, paying close and deep attention to her as well. The story ends with a quote of a poem that one of them wrote for her on Mother's Day recently. "When I first met you, those were dark days. In that time, I was stuck in my dark way. There was no light, so you set the world ablaze and you snapped me out of that phase. Then you went further, showing me you cared, answering my calls. Now I know that you'll be there. Then you asked questions, so I slowly shared. This world you showed me is simply more fair. You pulled me out of a world where I was not clear. Glad you did. There was no more air. But now these days I'm full of smile and full of play. Hope you feel love today. So I'd like to take this moment to say, thank you, Mom. I love you." I had never gone through these things with Leroy and D'Artagnan expecting a thank you or acknowledgement. It wasn't why I was in this, Lisa says. "You know, when people ask me what surprises me about our story, I say it's that they loved me back." So what does all of that have to do with prayer? Just because there are a couple of references to prayer in that story, it has to do with prayer because those couple of references are surprising within our culture and within our normal way of seeing things. Surprising invitations to see God at work in places we might look right past, in people we might look right past, in parts of our own hearts, in aspects of our own motives and needs that we might look right past. Don't take it lightly when someone says, "You are an answer to prayer because I've been praying and you showed up." And don't be surprised when prayer happens with your eyes open more than with your eyes closed. And don't be surprised when spiritual power is unleashed in the world simply because you followed your heart, followed the calling of your heart. And don't be surprised that things move in the world in those places where attentiveness and persistence join hands. Richard Rohr, in the video clip we saw earlier in the worship service, said some things worth repeating, I think. He said, whatever you do in a state of communion, of connection, of love, use all of them equally, is prayer. Whatever you do outside a state of union is non-prayer. When you are acting out of a state of conscious union with what you're doing, with God, with the person across from you, I sincerely believe that's the deepest meaning of prayer. So prayer is primarily a stance. It's a way of being in the world, he said. It's a connected way, a way of love and communion. And then he talked, you might remember, about Jesus praying in the wilderness for 40 days and how he didn't imagine that Jesus was praying words for 40 days, but rather putting one foot in front of another in conscious union with God. Putting one foot in front of another in conscious union with God. It's another way of talking about being deeply present, deeply attentive. Present to what? Attentive to what? Present to God. Attentive to God's whispers, God's nudges. Present to your own deep desires and your own deep fears. Attentive to the desires and fears and potential of those around you. Present to the hopes and pains of the world, attentive to what you can do in the world. That's all prayer. All those things pointed in the direction of communion, of connection, of love. That's all prayer. Jesus' disciples ask him to teach them to pray, so he gives them words that they can speak and stories for them to think about. He lifts up things like praise and gratitude and forgiveness and trust, and he suggests to them that perseverance is critical, perseverance and relationship and curiosity and initiative. But in the end, to teach someone to pray is no more and no less than inviting them to become a person who is deeply compassionate and deeply aware and deeply engaged. God is already at work. God is already present. God is already reaching toward you with love and grace. Will you learn to see it? Will we learn to touch it? That's what it means to learn to pray. To begin to see and touch the ways in which God is present in the world, at work in the world. To see it, to touch it, to affirm it, to act in concert with it. I suspect we don't need to learn more words of prayer. Maybe we just need to learn to explore and express more of our yearning for communion with God. And then the words will come, because the heart will know what to say. Amen.